Welcome to the show, Paul. How are you doing, man?
G'day, Mike. Thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. And I've been wanting to have you on for quite some time now. But you have a couple books, one that just came out in May, Echoes of Eden, and one that came out 2020, 2021, Scars of Eden, the Scars of Eden. Now, what, I guess, for people that don't know who you are, obviously I do, maybe a few others that listen to me or follow me know who you are, but just give a brief rundown of your background and what led you to research the material that you have researched over the years.
Well, people know me today for writing in the field of paleocontact. And paleocontact is the theory that in the deep past, our ancestors had contact with other civilizations, with other species. And it's my route into that territory that really takes people by surprise, because my background is in Christian ministry. I was for 33 years a church doctor, a theological educator, training pastors, and an archdeacon for the Anglican Church in Australia. And it was out of that background that I got into this field, really through the, I think it was the middle job I named, theological educator, because I was training pastors in hermeneutics. And what hermeneutics is the principles of interpreting ancient texts. And so for pastors, the main text they're handling, of course, is the Bible. And so I would train them in the tools of interpretation, source analysis, to look at where does this text come from? Is it the same as the original form? If it differs, why does it differ? What does that tell us? Form criticism, what kind of literature is this? Is it history with interpretation? Is it apocalyptic, where the writer saw something, didn't understand it, wrote it down for us to interpret? Is it poetry? Is it prophecy? And then always the linguistic question, what do the words mean? And it's actually applying those tools to some little knots and anomalies in the stories of the Bible that led me down the rabbit hole into the whole world of ancient ET contact.
And just for everybody that's listening, I will give the links to his website, his YouTube channels, and also his books in the description. Just check them all out. But Paul, just to state in the beginning of this interview, I was raised a Christian from a newborn into a Pentecostal church in the Bible Belt of the U.S., a type of fire and brimstone type church. I just want to let people know that what I say and or what Paul says in this interview is not in any way attacking Christianity. I believe Paul is a Christian. I am not an atheist, and I am very spiritual and do believe in a higher power. The problem is I do believe that the human race has been hijacked by a malevolent, evil, sinister force since the very beginning. And our true origins may not be quite what we have been told. What's your thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, I think people sometimes do listen to my conclusions. They hear me talking about ET contact or populated universe, or talking about stories of contact in the Bible. And they'll often jump to the conclusion that I'm attacking Orthodox Christianity or attacking the Bible. Whereas in fact, when you read my books, you'll discover what they're actually about is understanding the Bible.
That's the same with me too, Paul. I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's the same with me. Like,
that's what it is. It's full of information.
And I live in the Bible Belt. You know, I get attacked. I don't even have people. The only people I talk to about these kind of topics is people like you that I'm interviewing right now. I have very few friends here in the Bible Belt. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's because it's been a taboo. And so it's out of no disrespect to believers who are part of the Bible Belt, because ET contact has been a taboo within Christianity, well, for almost 2,000 years. It was really in the second century of the Common Era that the aspects of Christianity and Judaism that touched on ET contact were really pushed out of the mainstream conversation, but they're still there in the text. So you go back to the Hebrew scriptures and to the New Testament scriptures, go to the root meanings, and there is another layer of story there that we don't often bring out, that translation choices in the past have obscured, And so my agenda is not to debunk the Bible, but to understand it and to realize that some of the stories that we have translated traditionally as God's stories are actually telling us something quite different when we go to the Hebrew and to the root meanings. And there are some key words that really open up the fact that the Bible is full of a diversity of entities, a diversity of species who intersected with our ancestors' lives in the deep past. So that's where I'm coming from.
And one of the biggest questions that I've ever had within my own, I guess, spiritual evolution, Paul, and probably many others out there, is, I guess, like, without, how do we know 100% that the books in the Bible were not plagiarized or malevolently edited to serve a particular agenda during the Council of Nicaea?
The Council of Nicaea is blamed for everything these days. Mm-hmm. But the Bible's formation is a long story, and it's something that all preachers, priests, pastors will study. When they go to seminary, theological college, they will study the history of the Bible, where it came from, how it came together. And so in my first book in the Eden series, Escaping from Eden, I talk a little bit about the stories of origins that are in the Bible. So that's Genesis 1 to 11, all the stories of beginnings. And those are some of the oldest stories in the Bible, which are the stories that, if we go to the figures of Abraham and Sarah in the story of the Bible, they come out of a Sumerian-based culture, and they bring with them the stories of origins they were taught. And so, unsurprisingly, Genesis 1 to 11 is a summary of the Sumerian stories of beginnings. And then at a later point, we get into the story of Moses, and he encounters Yahweh, and you've got the Yahwistic law, which becomes the Mosaic law. And so you've then got books that were added to teach the Mosaic law. And then at a later stage, more books are added to teach history interpreted through the second layer of law. So that's called the Deuteronomistic history. Then at a later stage, more books are added that come from the priestly tradition of Judaism. And so that really places the Levitical priesthood in context. And then you've got prophetic texts. So you've got this growing library of books and scrolls forming the Hebrew canon. And it's a story of evolution. Different scrolls arrive with different agendas. You've got a bunch of scrolls that are there to teach the law, a bunch of scrolls there to authenticate the monarchy, a bunch of scrolls to authenticate the priesthood and show their role within Judaism. So you've got these additions and these agendas that all shape up the multiple agenda of the Bible. And then there's a very broad scholarly consensus that in the 6th century BCE, some redactors, scissors and paste editors, sat down and reworked that library so that it would become a seamless story, teaching monotheism, which was Judaism's great contribution to world thought. But part of that process was to go back to the earlier stories that acknowledged other entities, that talked about paleo contact, and the translation choices that were made to teach monotheism made it harder for the reader to realize they were reading stories of contact. They were reading stories of colonization. And so my books go back and say, just take a look at those stories again. Read it by the root meanings instead of the translations that we're familiar with. And these other layers of the story immediately become crystal clear. And you realize that the Bible stories of contact run in parallel with ancestral narratives of contact, ET contact in the deep past that exist in cultures all around the world. And suddenly you're reading the Bible in its context instead of in this tiny thought bubble.
Do you think it's possible Well said, Paul. Do you think it's possible that it was actually in context, maybe almost word for word? Maybe some of these, what we call myths of now, mythologies. I'm not talking the Bible. I'm talking about like other myths and mythologies. Do you think it's possible that a lot of those were left out of the Bible, or maybe possibly destroyed in the Library of Alexandria? Who did all this? That's for debate. But what's your thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, history is full of stories of conquests and imperial expansion. And an aspect of conquest and imperial expansion is always controlling the narrative. If you take power, if you become the government, especially if you're the new government from outside, you have to be the arbiter of what is news and what is fake news, what is true, what is false, what is knowledge and what is folklore. Mm-hmm. And so you see the Roman Empire doing this as it anchors itself to Christianity and morphs Christianity into the Imperial Department of Religion. Increasingly, decisions about doctrine are being centralized to the point where in the fourth century, the Roman Emperor decides what's true and what's false, what's orthodox and not orthodox, what will be considered biblical and what won't. Well, what's it got to do with the Roman Emperor? And then you see it expressed in, if you think about the conquests of Central and South America, where the Catholic forces of Portugal and Spain went in, deleted the indigenous narratives, replaced them with Christian orthodoxy or Catholic orthodoxy, getting rid of stories of paleo contact and replacing them with a simpler story of beginnings that the church had embraced at that time. So that's a part of the pattern. There is a sort of deliberate forgetting of the old knowledge.
So history is written by the victors?
All through history. Exactly. History is written by the victors. And any government wants full spectrum dominance over its people. If you've conquered a country and you're the new government and you say there was no massacre in that square when you took the country over, you don't want other news agencies saying, oh, actually there was. And of course, in the past, other news agencies meant priesthoods, meant royal families, and other information meant other holy books or other stories of origins. And so you can see this play out all through history, where the memory of old knowledge, old experience is pushed down into the grassroots, so that it's the folklore that will remember the stories of paleo contact, while the schools and churches are teaching the orthodox view where there's no paleo contact. So an example of this, for instance, would be my family. I have roots in Ghana. And in Ghana, if you go to school, you will be taught modern scientific view of life. And depending on what school you go to, you might be taught the Christian orthodox view of life as well. If you want to know about the company in which we live on planet Earth that is not human, and the company in the cosmos that is not human, you find that knowledge in the folklore, because Ghanaians have always known about this. They've always had these stories of contact. But after the British went into Ghana in the 1870s, all that information was pushed out of the school syllabus and replaced with the British school syllabus. So the knowledge is still there, but it's just not in school. It's just not on the news. And so in my research for the Eden series, that's where I go to find a lot of information to indigenous narratives, to folklore, and found to my great surprise that the folklore of diverse cultures spread all around the globe are carrying very, very similar information about who we are and where we all came from.
Very well said. And so since just because Christianity, I guess what you are doing, Paul, with your research, just because Christianity survived over the years and was, I guess, lack of a better term, maybe victorious in spreading the gospel and the truth, doesn't necessarily mean it's the only truth. There's other stories out there that maybe have similar parallels and maybe similar origin stories. And maybe you're just trying to cipher out which ones to are maybe correlate and I guess paint a better picture of our true origins. Is that, am I gathering that correctly, Paul?
Well, that's right. I think a lot of Christian believers have no problems saying there is information outside of Christianity. A lot of Christians have no problems going to school and learning chemistry that you won't find in the Bible, or learning applied physics that you won't find in the Bible, or learning accounting. You know, there is information outside of Christianity. The problem is who we allow to teach us. Is there information carried by other cultures? Is there information carried by folklore? And then there is a strand within Christianity that kind of believes there is no information outside of Christianity.
That's how I was kind raised, of believes, Paul.
Yeah.
That's how,
but if you go to university, you know, chemistry, what's that? Applied physics, what's that? There's a total disrespect for knowledge outside of the church. And this is there because of historic theological reasons. It comes from Calvinism. It comes from Augustinianism. It is the implication of the doctrines of original sin and total depravity that basically says there's no information outside of the church. Well, if you hold that view, you might struggle with what's in my books, because what I do in my books is show that the Bible is actually part of a family of information, a family of narratives that gives us a coherent picture about who we are, where we came from, and that when you go, for instance, to the folklore of Central and South America and hear stories of ET visitation in the deep past, you're not hearing anything that's contrary to the Bible. You're actually hearing another expression of stories that are in the Bible that are just a translation away from being blindingly obvious.
Man, I wish I would have had you as a pastor growing up, Paul. It would have made life a lot easier. Women at my, literally, I was from a toddler, just a few months old, all the way at the same church, all the way up until I was 16, 17, right before I shipped out for the military. But women could not wear, you know, pants. They couldn't wear any makeup, earrings, jewelry. It was very, the hair had to be longer than, I forgot where, it's certain length. It couldn't be short, you know, and it was, yeah. And I would say my church, and I've been to many churches, my wife's church that I go to every now and then, it's a Baptist church. And it's a lot different than what I was raised with, being fire and brimstone and basically I feel like we were controlled mostly through fear. And I know that's not all churches. I know that.
Yeah. No, it's not all churches, but it is something that happens within Christianity and within other religions all around the world, where people who run the religion really use the frightening aspects of the faith to pacify and control and manage a congregation. If disagreeing with the pastor puts you on a slippery slope that can lead you to a fiery hell, well, you're not going to disagree with the pastor. That's the kind of doctrine a pastor will be very happy to preach. So unfortunately, there are those distortions that can occur. But I think that what's important for people to realize is the church is a great spectrum of experiences. So there are churches like the one you grew up in, there's churches like the one your wife attends, and there are churches like the Syrian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, deeply interesting historic churches that go right back to the time of the apostles. There's this great spectrum. And I think whatever church you go to, it's important to know that Christianity is a bigger phenomenon than what you're experiencing in your congregation. You're something part of something huge and kaleidoscopic. And in the beginning, Christianity was even bigger and more kaleidoscopic than it is today. You go back to the beginnings of Christianity, and there were experiences and practices that it would blow your mind to think, oh my goodness, this was on the menu in the early church. Yes, it absolutely was. A lot of people would be very surprised to know that channeling was part of primitive Christianity.
I was about to say some abilities, or some things maybe back then, maybe some of the lost knowledge, what we would call supernatural today.
Exactly. So you say channeling in a lot of churches, and they say, oh, no, that's New Age, or that's demonic. We don't go there. Well, the early Christians did, and you can read about it in 1 John. It's in the New Testament. If I talk to some Christians about contact with or encouragement from our ancestors or ancestral spirits, oh, no, that's not Christianity. That's like African voodoo. No, it isn't. It's Christian. It's in Hebrews, and it was part of the experience of the early Christians. Was it? Absolutely. Go back to Hebrews and have another read. And these experiences that were part of the early kaleidoscope of Christianity were really only pushed out for the reasons we were previously talking about, where if you want to run Christianity as a kind of feudal order with a powerful person at the top and disempowered people at the bottom, an emperor at the top alongside God and bishops and senators in the middle and priests and people at the bottom, anything like that, or a pastor at the top and the people at the bottom, then you don't want everyone having their own access to their own information. So the 1 John 4 encouraging Christians to get information from spirits, or Hebrews expecting people to be in contact with ancestral spirits, we ignore that. We don't preach on that here. It's in the Bible, so you can't get rid of it, but we just neglect it. And we stick to this much simpler, narrower picture. These are the doctrines. These are the things you have to believe. Here's your Bible. Here's your prayer meeting. Stick with the program. And we have forgotten how diverse Christianity originally was. And in the beginning, Christianity was very open to stories of a populated cosmos, stories of contact with cosmic neighbors. And it was only later that that was pushed out of the Christian mainstream.
So what it sounds like to me, Paul, with the way you saying it, it was used to be completely different than it is today. Completely different for the most
it
part.
It was very different. Very, okay. Very different.
Go ahead. Go on. Okay.
Well, just as another example, if I say today, are you open to the idea that you might have had a life before this one? People say, oh, that's not Christianity. That's Buddhism. That's Hinduism. Well, no, actually, if you read the early church fathers, they were open to that possibility. That was part of the worldview into which Jesus stepped. That was the start point from which the apostles started teaching. And that's why even in the Gospels, when Jesus says to his followers, his 12, who do people say I am? One of the answers is, well, a lot of people think you are a reincarnation of one of the prophets, telling us straight away that the idea that Jesus might have had a previous life was part of what people were thinking at that time. So there's a whole world of ideas and information that was part of mainstream Christian conversation in the beginning that we've forgotten and that we need to recover.
That's amazing. So it seems like, I guess, the modern day, well, that I've observed, and I'm sure you and others possibly as well, that modern day Christianity, with no disrespect at all, I believe in the way the preachers are preaching, I've been to many, many churches, it's almost like the Disneyland version of the actual truth. What do you think about that?
Well, I think a lot of time we get a very edited version of Christianity, that the syllabus could be this and you're getting this. And I hear from Oh, every week I hear from people in ministry, pastors, youth pastors, people in seminary, retired pastors, who will say things like, this is an experience I had that I never mentioned in church. Or this is something that happened to our family that we were never allowed to mention in church. Or I asked my pastor questions about close encounters or ETs in the Bible. And he said, well, I'll tell you privately, but I can never say this in public. And you realize that there are two layers of information, what's known privately and what's preached publicly. And to just to be fair on the pastors, there are a lot of things they might not feel free to preach publicly because the congregation will be very, or their elders will be very swift to say, you've gone off syllabus, pastor, and you're not going to stay here if you're going to start talking like that.
He'd be without a job.
Their respect for the great teacher will evaporate the moment he says something that's taboo or off syllabus. And so I do hear from a lot of people who said, well, my dad told me privately, but he said I can never preach this in church because the people wouldn't accept it.
And I can see that. I can see that the pastors are holding back, and they probably, that's all most pastors do. They study the scripture, and they probably know more than what they are explaining.
Allowed to say. And to be fair to a lot of pastors, they will push the people as far as they can, get their curiosity as far as it's safe to do so, but they might have been told in no uncertain terms, these are the fundamental truths here, and you don't stray from those if you want to keep your job. So for most pastors, whether they've been told that or not, there's still a bit of a dance, because you still have to think, what can this congregation handle? And some congregations are stretchier than others. If you're in a church that's defined by a doctrinal basis, that can be harder work for the pastor to dance around. Whereas in an historic church like the Anglican Church, Catholic Church, Orthodox Church, where you've got a lot of history and liturgy holding the show on the road, often you find the clergy there have a bit more freedom to say to their people, you might want to go and study up on Genesis 6. You might want to go away and read Hebrews 12 or 1 John 4 and see what you think. Because it isn't a narrow set of conclusions holding the community together. And I think we need to give each other permission to read the Bible with an open eye, an open ear, and ask questions. Because reading the Bible with curiosity has actually been an engine for discovery and knowledge through the ages. It's something that has fired up scientific inquiry at different times. I think curiosity is not something to be afraid of. I think often we've been taught to be afraid of it in religious circles. But to my mind, curiosity is the thing that makes us human. It's the thing that turned us into a technological species and made so many things possible for us that's possible for no other life form on the planet.
And I can only imagine the church I grew up in, any church, I would say any church, especially here or anywhere in the world, if the pastor was in front of the congregation and said that, you know, in Genesis, that snake is actually a reptilian alien, or saying something like that, you know, just, but I don't mean to even get on that. That was just off the top of my head. What, now explain the snake in Genesis, in the Garden of Eden, and what, according to your research up until this point, what with Christianity and our origins, what does the snake symbolize?
Yeah. Well, you see, if you say reptilian today, then a lot of people think, oh, I know what that is. And then I know straight away that this is something malevolent and anti-human. Or you say the word snake, it's immediately something negative and terrifying. But then there are clues in the Bible that there's another side to this story as well. So, for instance, you get to the story of the snake being lifted up on the pole by Moses so that people can be healed of snake bite. And you're thinking, hold on, what's happening now? Is that snake a symbol of healing? Or is this actually a recollection of a period in Jewish history where there were other entities? I mean, snakes that bite, that's not a positive story. Why do you have to bow down to the snake? Is there an earlier version of that story that becomes clearer when we go to root meanings? Come back to the snake in Genesis. And I think because of 2,000 years of preaching and interpretation, we often fast forward to a conclusion. Ah, that's the devil. Well, the text doesn't say it's the devil. Ah, that's Satan. The text does not say that snake is Satan. We fast forward to reading it as a snake, despite the fact that at the beginning of the story, it's speaking human and appears to have limbs. So what kind of entity is it? Because it turns up in the story with no introduction. Now, if you read a child's Bible with a child, the child will point all this out to you. Who's the serpent? Why did God make the serpent? Couldn't God see where this was going to lead? Couldn't he see what the humans were going to do? Couldn't he see the humans would want to eat that fruit? Why is it the death penalty for a fruit? A child will ask all these questions, and most parents, if they're honest, will struggle to answer. Why is it that God wants to keep the humans so unintelligent they don't even know they're naked? Why is it the serpent who wants the humans to have a better human experience, wants them to be more conscious, wants them to be more intelligent? Why is it God blocking human progress and the snake in favor? A child will pick all this apart. And most parents and most preachers will do their best to answer the question and come away thinking, gee, I really need to get a better answer to that because it doesn't quite make sense to me either. In my research for Escaping from Eden, I discovered that the story of the snake in Genesis 3 is a retelling of a Sumerian story. So remember now, we're in Genesis 1 to 11. These are the Sumerian stories Abraham and Sarah brought with them from the Sumerian culture. The original Sumerian version of this story is the argument between Enlil and Enki. That's the story Abraham and Sarah would have read and have retold in Genesis 3. The original version of the story, there's no devil, there's no Satan in the story. It's not a battle between God and the devil or good and evil. It's a battle between two beings who are in an argument over how intelligent they want the human beings to be. One wants them to have a happy human experience as fertile, conscious, intelligent beings. There are to be a male and a female and procreation, just like all the other animals. And the other one, Enlil, says, no, we just want them smart enough to work for us. And the way that's been translated, the one against is now the God character, and the one in favor of the upgrade is the snake character. The original version, you suddenly realize, oh, this makes sense. That's what this is about. It's an upgrade. And the way it's translated at the moment,
this was before the flood, Paul?
Before the flood. So we call it the fall, whereas in fact, it's a story of an upgrade and the shape of the story is still there. So the way it's been left is very, very confusing for Jewish and Christian believers because it's departed from the original form. The original form, the Sumerian story, makes it clear. Read the two stories alongside each other, and it's like a light bulb goes on. Oh, my goodness. And then you realize how many assumptions you've made, how many assumptions clicked on the moment you read the word snake, for instance. But it's not all down to our mistake. It's down to that edit I mentioned before, because the holy name of God is now washing around in that text. It wasn't there in the beginning. This is from a time long before Moses. The fact that you've got the holy name Yahweh in the text tells you straight away that a writer after the time of Moses has retold the story and retold the story to teach something different than the original version. So this
is Yahweh symbolized as Enlil? Is Yahweh symbolized as Enlil? Because according to my research, Enlil was the vengeful one, just like in the Old Testament.
That's right, he's in that role.
And Enki was the scientist and the more easygoing, loving I guess, of the Anunnaki.
So in the original version of the story, Enlil is the commander in charge of this region of space, and his older brother, Enki, is on planet Earth managing Project Earth. Enki is the one on the planet with the humans, and he can see that it's not a happy human experience until we're fertile, conscious, and intelligent, and he wanted to upgrade us to have a better human experience because he was closer to us. So that's the original version of the story. So I would encourage people to go and read that, then come back to Genesis 3 and you'll read it with new eyes and realize, oh, of course, this is a retelling. But it's been made confusing for us because of the importation of the name of God into the text. And when we see that, we think, oh, this is a God story then. And we read it awry because of that.
Do you think everything has gotten so confusing because everything you just said and we just discussed about the Sumerian civilization and Enki and Enlil? Of course, we know that Eric von Däniken talks about them, Zachariah Sitchin, other people like Michael Tellinger, The Slave Species of Gods. He basing his work on Zachariah Sitchin. And you do a very brilliant job also with your research as well into this. But why has it gotten so murky? Why has the stories, has it been infiltrated by certain rogue ancient governmental shadowy figures behind the scenes to where they kind of murky it up a little bit to keep us confused? And because the more we're confused, the more we know our ancient past, the more empowerment we have.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that we have been taught to look down on folklore. We've been taught to look down on other cultures. We've been taught to read the Bible a particular way. And I think all that does muddy the picture. I talked earlier about the formation of the Bible, where you've got an edit that's done to teach the law. You've got an edit that's done to authenticate the monarchy. You've got an edit that's done to authenticate the priesthood. Those are all agendas that are different from explaining the early stories of paleo contact. You have to realize it's a totally different agenda. And so every time there was an addition and an edit made, it muddied the picture up a little further. And that's why I've written my Eden series, to say we can get through that. We can get through the fog by going back to the root meanings of the words. Because even though there were these distortions as the edits came, the words are still there, and the meanings of the words are still there. The ancient stories are still carried by the ancient texts. That's really the power of the scripture, to have maintained these stories. So they haven't disappeared. It's just a matter of learning to listen without prejudice to stories we may have dismissed in the past, cultures we may have dismissed in the past, and to go beyond familiar translations and conventions and ask the question, have we read that right? And if we're willing to ask questions like that, we can actually push back all the mists of confusion and get clarity. And the greatest clarity comes when you hear the stories alongside each other, from the Hebrew scriptures to the Greek legends, to Norse mythology, to the Vedas, to African story. When you hear the same history being repeated, the same ancient science being reported, a coherent picture emerges.
Now, I believe Zachariah Sitchin and Eric von Däniken, they're both brilliant, the late Zachariah Sitchin. They both brilliant researchers. But if you had to pick one, for somebody to fully research in the beginning, that somebody that's maybe unfamiliar with all this, do you go with Zachariah Sitchin or do you go with Eric von Däniken? Which one, if you had to pick one for somebody to start off with?
Well, my start.
Yours too. your Echoes of Eden and
Obviously I'd point people to my books, but my start point was Erich von Däniken. When I wrote Escaping from Eden, which is the first of the trilogy, there's Escaping from Eden, The Scars of Eden, and Echoes of Eden. When I was towards the end of writing Escaping from Eden, that's when I discovered Zechariah Sitchin. I'd never heard of him. And suddenly I came across him in my research and I thought, oh, I'm not the first person to draw these conclusions about ancient ET contact from the Mesopotamian story and relate it to the Bible. So what should I do? Should I stop writing my book, read everything Zechariah Sitchin wrote, and then come back to writing the book? And I thought, no, I won't do that because I don't want to write a he said, she said kind of book. I want to follow the data that's in front of me, apply to the data my own logic, make my own journey as a preacher, lecturer, theological educator. This is my journey and I'm going to make it, and then I'm going to share the journey. And then if my conclusions in any way overlap with Zechariah Sitchin's, that's far more interesting to a reader than to read someone who read Zechariah Sitchin. To read different writers who've taken different data, applied their own logic to it, and now they're coming to the same conclusions, well, that's far more interesting. So I thought, that's what I'll do. So I have not read Zechariah Sitchin's great body of material. I'm still pursuing data and producing my material, and people are still finding there's this overlap. For me, it was Erich von Däniken who sowed the seed of the idea that we might be in a populated universe. I read Chariots of the Gods back when I was 11 years old, and I felt that he had very reasonably put his finger on a problem in our ability to explain ourselves as a conscious, intelligent, technological species. There were just enormous gaps in our ability to explain that. And he said, would our story as a species make more sense if we allowed for the possibility of external interventions that nudged us forward in our progress? Now, Erich von Däniken wasn't the first person to say this. 2,500 years before Erich von Däniken was a writer called Plato, absolutely foundational to Christian thinking. A lot of Christians don't know this. The Apostle Paul was a total fan of Plato. Many of the Apostle Paul's most famous quotes are actually Plato quotes that Paul's done a little spin on. Plato also taught populated universe. We're in company now. We're in company in the deep past, and we had visits in the deep past that upgraded us for greater consciousness and intelligence. So really, you can take your pick. Zechariah Sitchin has a wonderful body of literature. He plumbs the Bible, Mesopotamian story, and other ancient narratives as well, and cosmology. And he puts it all into a very readable form for a popular audience. Erich von Däniken, I take my hat off to him because he's really the one who broke the taboo and made paleo contact something for mainstream conversation. And he was my personal introduction. But if you've got the time, read Plato, Erich von Däniken, Zechariah Sitchin, Paul Wallace, and you'll have a 360-degree view by then, I should think.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt you, but what I was going to say is that you actually, you have an upper hand, and a lot of people should look into your books and your research, because my mother she tells me to this very day, and I'm 36. My wife's about to be, she just turned 38. And she's 3 months pregnant. We've been trying for 10 years.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I think this is the first time I've said it on here. But anyway, so I'm going to be a father and she's going to be a mother. My mother to this very day, son, whenever you have kids, you have to raise your kids better than how you were raised, because each generation will continue to get better and better and better. So what I'm trying to say is, Paul, you have studied a lot of people's research. You have studied Eric von Däniken's research. You have come to your own conclusions. You're a pastor. You have studied Christianity in detail. So people may need to invest into your research, because that was older research back in the day. And just like my mother said, you have to do better than how you were raised. So just like you, I'm sure you were trying to do more and more due diligent research than what the forefathers gave to us.
Well, every generation needs the taboo breaking on these kinds of topics. And every generation will need it broken in a way that's appropriate for that generation. And my hope is that my books will be a gateway into this topic for people who otherwise wouldn't consider it. So I hope that my books will appeal to some who wouldn't read Sitchin or wouldn't read Eric von Däniken, out of no disrespect to them. But because of the journey I've made, I am finding I am reaching people who previously wouldn't have given this a second thought. And partly because of where I've come from, how I've reached these conclusions, but also because I've written my books as personal story. They are easy reads, and they're not books where I've set myself up as the expert. I'm saying, look, I've made this journey. Can I share this journey with you? And they're easy to read that way. I like to think they're quite amusing as well, and that's enough to carry a reader from the beginning to the end. And a reader might start very skeptical of the topic, but the story will carry them through, and by the end they'll be saying, actually there is something here for me to give some serious thought to.
So briefly, Cliff Notes version of The Scars of Eden versus The Echoes of Eden.
All right, I'll do the three. So in Escaping of Eden, I show how studying the Bible got me into this topic, opened up a totally unfamiliar story of who we are and where we came from, with implications for who we are today and what we're capable of. The Scars of Eden then ask the question, so what? What difference does it make? How, if there was contact in the past, how has that affected how the planet functions today? Does our geopolitics exist the way it does because of contact in the past? Does how we live our lives take the shape it does because of ET contact? What do I do about this information? And so The Scars of Eden goes there and looks at how this has played out through history and what we might do differently in the light of it. Echoes of Eden goes back to that question of, okay, so if we are an engineered species, and if in the past we were more intelligent and more conscious, as the ancient narratives say, how do we switch our higher abilities back on? If it's there, latent in our brains, how do we activate it, and how do we have a better human experience on planet Earth? And that's the territory I explore in Echoes. In Echoes of Eden, I go and sit at the feet of elders of the indigenous traditions that have maintained a knowledge of our deep past and our contact in the deep past. And so it opens up a global picture. So starting from Escaping from Eden, you start in Victoria, Australia. By the time you get to the end of Echoes of Eden, you've traveled around the world twice. And you've learned from almost every culture on the planet in the process.
Man, before we wind things up, I have just a few questions. I haven't even touched any of my notes. Maybe a few. I did touch a couple, but I'm just having a fun conversation, just like me and you sit on a couch and just going at it, you know. But I, like I said, definitely got to have you on somewhere down the road, and then somewhat in the near future, and so we can touch on experiences, because I have a few experiences you may want to listen to, and then touch on the abduction phenomena.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the reasons I knew I had to write The Scars of Eden was because of hearing from veterans of war and things they had seen, experiences they had had, and realizations they had made about the way the world works that really opened up the human story in an amazing way for them and in an amazing way for me. And that's part of the journey of The Scars of Eden. So I'll look forward to that conversation with you.
Will do. So you said the one that just came out in May, the Echoes of Eden. You touch upon some geopolitical type issues, that correct?
Well, it's actually in The Scars of Eden where I go to an idea that was put forward in the 1500s by Robert Kirk, who was a Presbyterian minister in Scotland, when he said, you cannot understand what happens on planet Earth geopolitically until you understand that there is a non-human layer to Project Earth and Project Humanity. And that non-human layer has been reported to us by ancestors of every culture. So he wrote that in the 1500s as a very conservative Presbyterian Christian minister, but he learned it by listening to the lived experience of people in Aberfoyle, Scotland at that time. What he learned there, he could have learned in any country in the world, but he learned it there. And The Scars of Eden really unpacks that idea that you will not understand why politics today works the way it does, why human society functions today in the way it does, until you understand the non-human layer in our story as a species.
So what I have written down, and well said, Paul, is the Great Reset. Hopefully I don't get tagged for saying that, but on my algorithm, but is the Great Reset actually another representation of the end of an age, the forward thinking from Pisces to the new age of Aquarius, or what many others have said in the past decades have said, the new world order?
Well, it's a very, very layered question, because when you go to the Bible and other ancestral narratives, you realize that the concept of periodic resets is part of the story. It happens at a planetary level, that there are periodic planetary resets. Plato talked about this, periodic cataclysms that take civilization down to a virtual zero, and then it has to reboot. But then also there are enormous socio-political resets at the fall of empires and the exchange of empires. And we're seeing something like that happening at the moment. There was a great historian who, I won't mention his name because it's a polarizing name and people don't necessarily understand what he was on about, but he was a great historian. He just talked about how human society goes through certain phases. So you start off with a primitive phase where it's based on the family, and then you have the tribe, and then you might have, you know, a kingdom or a fiefdom, and you've got landlords who war against each other, and then you reach the point where you've got farming and city building, and then you get to the city state, and then the city state takes over a region and you evolve into a nation, and then the nation evolves and becomes an empire. And then he said you reach a point where the empires are no longer at the top of the tree. You've got corporations more powerful than the empires, but they'll reach a point at which the interests of ordinary human beings are so far removed from the interests of the elites who run the corporations that they will simply buy out of that in the same way they bought out of the Roman Empire. And there's a reset where we have to rediscover each other at a much more local level, where the economy that functions will be the local economy, where you will get your food from the local economy, where you'll get your expertise from the local economy. And clearly, to go from a global pattern of functioning where it's corporations running the show to a local, there's going to be an enormous turbulence to get you from that point to that point. And I think we are now in that turbulence. Meanwhile, you have the elites who call the shots, who impose policies on national governments, who might foment war, or at other times broke a peace because of interest, nothing to do with nations, but to do with corporations. And so you'll have people in those invisible layers to us who are pulling strings, who themselves might want to operate differently to at present. Then you've got the non-human layer. If there really is something like a Sky Council or an intergalactic federation, to use the words of Haim Ashed, the former chief of space security for Israel, the brigadier general held that position for 27 years. If that's a reality, then you will have allies of humanity saying, this isn't working well for the humans. We need some change. And then you might have others on the Galactic Federation saying, stuff the humans, we want more resources, or whatever it is they're here for. So you've got turbulence at that level as well. So I don't think it's a simple picture of there's a group of people who want to take the world from A to B. I think it's much messier than that. There's much more in the blender than that. But we're certainly in that turbulence leading up to massive change at a global level.
And to go on that, Paul, so is one of the agendas, and I agree, it's much more than what people think it really is. So is one of the agendas of the Great Reset, or the New World Order, but people were saying, you know, they're using the Great Reset as of late, but it's one of the agendas of the Great Reset to dehumanize us on every level, while keeping the shackles on our spiritual growth and evolution of our consciousness as a species.
That is one agenda. Absolutely. That is one agenda that operates at the non-human layer, but it also operates at the human layer. You know, if you've got governments who want manageable populations, that is an energy within their thinking as well. But there's other energy in the mix as well that's counter to that, that's more democratic, that's more empowering. So I think it's messy. I think we're in for a turbulent century for sure. But what will be reset and what it'll be reset to, it's not like there's just a few people who can really control what's going to happen. There's certainly a few with a lot of control, but it's not total. So it's not like it's all set in stone in advance.
So thank you very much, Paul. I will definitely have you on somewhere down the road, hopefully in the near future, because man, we can talk for hours, and I didn't even touch not even half the notes that I have. A lot of the stuff was just on top of my head, just responding to some things that you were talking about, but this was very fascinating. And where can everybody find your work again? I told everybody in the beginning, but you go ahead and lay everything out for everybody, your books, websites, and the YouTube channels also.
Well, if you go to Amazon, Kindle, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold, you'll find Escaping from Eden, The Scars of Eden, Echoes of Eden. If you read those, or if you want to get in a conversation with me, you can find me on The Fifth Kind on YouTube and on the Paul Wallace channel as well on YouTube. I'm in the comments every day having conversations with people. And just to keep up with me in general, go to my website, which is paulanthonywallace.com, Anthony with an H, Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S, paulanthonywallace.com. And if you're interested in doing coaching with me, go to the website and you'll find the coaching page and we can get into a conversation there.
Well, Paul, it's a treat, an honor, privilege, and we will definitely keep in touch, and I salute you, my friend.
Thanks, Mike. I look forward to next time.
Thank you very much for tuning in to this edition of Beyond the Forbidden. Like, subscribe, drop the comments below, and look in the description for some of the show notes and or links to my other social medias. But you can also find me on BitChute by searching Beyond the Forbidden Odyssey. You can search also Odyssey Beyond the Forbidden and Instagram, which is at Beyond the Forbidden. And Facebook is facebook.com/beyondtheforbidden, or just search Facebook Beyond the Forbidden. And also search Peter Badwolf. He is in the description below. You can check out his links. But until next time, y'all have a good one.